and now Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, Dr. Gerald Horn, a prolific writer who addresses issues of racism and a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war, whose last two books, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, will inform this morning's discussion. And as far as I'm concerned, Gerald Horn is a national treasure, and he joins us now to continue our Black Lives Matter discussion. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
Well, let's start with the function, the character of policing of African Americans, and we can take it back to really your remarkable and important work, The Counter-Revolution of 1776.
That is correct. I think you cannot begin to understand Eric Garner and Michael Brown and all the rest without an understanding of the intersection of slavery and the founding of the United States of America. That is to say that in 1776, when the United States of America was proclaimed, to its credit, it broke with the religious Cold War. That is to say, Protestants versus Catholics, and both of those against those who were Jewish. But basically, they replaced that axis with a new axis, that is to say, race, that is to say, so-called white versus so-called non-white. That meant that Africans were to be enslaved, Native Americans to be dispossessed, Mexicans to be dispossessed, Asians to be barred. And given the fact that Africans tended to be the most hostile internal opponents of the proclamation of 1776, not least because 1776 basically meant a new birth of freedom for enslavers, that also meant that Africans were designated as the internal enemy. The internal enemy, of course, is the title of a recent Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Alan Taylor of the University of Virginia. That helped to create a culture where even today, people of African descent are considered to be an eternal outlier, an eternal enemy of this republic. The second lesson, however, is that we have been able to overcome that designation over the decades and centuries, not least because of our ability to lengthen the battlefield and forge international alliances. That is to say, international alliances with Haitian revolutionaries. You recall that 1791 to 1804 was the Haitian Revolution, which left a deep imprint on slavery and anti-slavery in the United States of America. We had alliances with British abolitionists. In the 20th century, of course, we saw two major challenges to the race project in the United States. First of all, there was the class project as initiated by the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And then there was the attempt by Tokyo to turn the tables on race by basically forging an alliance of the so-called non-white against the so-called white. Both of those projects, as you know, did not work out very well. And so, therefore, it's no accident, it's no surprise that there's been a reversion with a vengeance to the race project. I think it's also fair to suggest that a significant percentage of Euro-Americans in the United States of America, for various reasons, have rejected the class project. It's no accident that Staten Island, which has been a bastion of the Euro-American working class, was the venue for the grand jury that voted a no bill of indictment against the police officers who murdered Eric Garner. This is no surprise because if you look at electoral statistics, you'll find a remarkable cross-class coalition, particularly in Dixie, where slavery was most intense. That is to say, 9 out of 10 Euro-Americans in Dixie vote for the same candidate. That is to say, the poor, the working class, the middle class, and the elite. It seems to me that until we address that particular nub of the issue, we will continue to have a spate of police killings because the police are basically only expressing the deepest values of the society in which they operate.
Gerald, take us through where you just were to the Jim Crow period, and then what Michelle Alexander calls really the new Jim Crow in terms of the functioning of police, obviously a systemic mechanism for control of populations that are the most rebellious and most likely to break with the status quo of the system. But you take it through in terms of your scholarship, your research, and historic findings.
Well, as is well known, the United States faced a problem after the U.S. Civil War as to what to do with this formerly enslaved population. There were repeated efforts to deport this population en masse. Brazil was considered, I considered that, you may recall in my book, The Deepest South in the United States, Brazil, and the African slave trade. Hispaniola was considered, Ecuador was considered, but as it turned out, none of those venues necessarily worked out. And so, in a sense, the United States was stuck with this black population. And they moved to Plan B, which was a form of neo-slavery, a form of debt slavery, a form of sharecropping, a form of law whereby if Africans were considered to be vagrants, they could be therefore imprisoned. In Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Gerald, one of the things that came to mind for me is you always place these things in an international context as well as a historic context. And I remembered William Patterson and presentations in 1951 by people, activists who were working around the issue of police brutality, police murder, police violence against populations of color going to the United Nations with the document, We Charge Genocide. So is part of where your studies take you that we have to begin to look at this, the solutions, the strategies for combating this mass terrorism against people of color in the international arena as well?
You've hit the nail right on the head. The part of the heartening events the past few months is, A, the parents of Michael Brown, the slain Ferguson, Missouri teenager, going to Geneva to testify before the United Nations Commission on Torture with regard to human rights violations in the state of Missouri. And second of all, a group of young black teenagers, predominantly in Chicago, under the rubric We Charge Genocide, also going to Geneva in order to testify about U.S. torture. This is exceedingly important because, as noted, we really have to think about internationalizing this question and lengthening the battlefield. That's why, on the other side of the ledger, it's rather disappointing that in light of the Feinstein Senate Committee torture report, which unveiled years of torture by the Central Intelligence Agency, there has been little effort, I'm afraid, to link the fact that during the time of slavery in the United States of America, the United States was basically a torture empire. Recent research has shown that in order to heighten productivity and profit of productivity of slaves and profit of slave owners, that the Africans were tortured to a fare-thee-well. And so it's no accident that in the 21st century, the United States once again emerges as a torture empire. It seems to me that the forces concerned with domestic repression need to link up with the forces concerned with global repression. That is to say that both sides of that equation need to bring a complaint, as your recent news report just suggested, a complaint before the International Criminal Court with regard to the leaders of the United States. But unlike your previous report, that complaint at the ICC should not only talk about what happened with regard to CIA victims, it should also talk about domestic victims, because I don't think you can understand one without understanding the other.
You know, recently Michael Brown's parents went to Geneva to testify. They had been invited to testify at the one of the UN commissions against torture. And took a rather dramatic stance there, which caused the U.S. Formal delegation to walk out in great discomfort. Talk about how you see the link just flesh it out a bit more in terms of the U.S. as a militarized society, the U.S. as a society that engages and rationalizes torture and the incredible violence that is occurring at the hands of the policing apparatus of the state against the black and the brown. How do we continue to elaborate on tying those things together and making that statement in the international arena?
A few points. One, it's well known that the Pentagon sells its so-called surplus military equipment to domestic police departments. We saw that in Ferguson, Missouri, for example. That suggests that there is an inextricable link between what the Pentagon does abroad in terms of bombings and Iraq, Syria border, Afghanistan, et cetera, and what the Pentagon does at home. Second of all, what this also suggests is that if our domestic forces, if our anti-repression forces at home, if our forces that are concerned about police brutality and torture at home do not have an international strategy, well, basically, it seems to me that they're setting themselves up for failure. It's difficult to see how we can talk about the rise of the right wing in the United States of America without talking about neo-Nazi marches that took place recently in Dresden, Germany, without talking about the rise of the National Front, the neo-fascist party in France, which may be in line to control the highest office in the land in France, without talking about the rise of the Freedom Party, the neo-right populists in both Holland and Austria, without talking about the UK Independence Party, which is along that same line. It seems to me that just by restricting our efforts to the domestic realm, number one, we're going against our history, a history that showed we were able to overcome slavery and Jim Crow by linting the battlefield, by going to the international arena, as suggested by the We Charge Genocide petition of 1950-1951. And it seems to me that it's meaning that we're trying to overcome a rather obdurate, stalwart right wing that just had a remarkable success in a low turnout election in November 2014 here in the United States of America, and thereby is flexing its muscles, is feeling its oats, and is in no mood to compromise. And the way we push them back is the way we push them back historically, by lengthening the battlefield.
Gerald, I have a question for you. You know, the previous segment, we just had some incredible young people on from different parts of the country, and they were making these connections as you're talking about right now with us. Are you seeing that as well in your interactions and your work with young people, the connections historically and internationally as well?
Well, I think that not only amongst young people, amongst broad sectors of the black community in particular, there's a desperate search for answers. There's an understanding that perhaps we hit the wall with regard to the compromises that were brokered in the 1950s, where in return for some civil rights, anti-Jim Crow concessions, that we would basically, like other U.S. nationals, leave foreign policy to the State Department. And not only that, but we turn our backs on our internationalist figures like Paul Robeson. That particular strategy has hit the wall. It seems to me it's exhausted itself. And I think that that realization has dawned on broader sectors. It's probably dawned most directly on the younger population, since they were not around in the 1950s and therefore do not have a stake in that particular compromise like some of our older leaders do. And I find that to be quite heartening.
Gerald, one of the things that you do so well in your writings, you always, of course, tie race and class together. And I'm interested in your thoughts on the not explicitly on the Moral Mondays movement, but certainly one of the things that the Moral Mondays movement does is it ties the accentuation and the exacerbation of racism in with the character and oppression of the economic system under which we live. And I wonder if you can do that and if you see the imperative of raising those connections and the whole nature of the workforce and the African-American workforce today today as one of the precursors to the aggressive, brutal policing that is occurring in communities of color?
Well, one of the reasons we salute Moral Monday is because they exemplify another important strand and trend in our history, which is putting one's body on the line, which is engaging in civil disobedience, which is mass action, direct action, etc. And therefore, they deserve our thanks. With regard to the workforce, you may have seen the New York Times yesterday, which reported some things some of us already knew, which is the rapid spread of robotization through diverse sectors of the economy. That is to say, in hotels, you have robots doing things that once human beings did in terms of delivering items to rooms. You have robots and computers doing the work of journalists, that is to say, churning out articles. We also know about offshoring, that is to say that lawyers' jobs in particular are increasingly being exported to India, which happens to be the largest English-speaking society on this small planet, and to the Philippines as well. The problem with the United States of America is that with the growth of the right wing, the idea of job retraining and job training to make up for the shortfall as technology takes over positions, job retraining and job training is basically off the table, and that suggests that there will be a large so-called surplus population, and even those states are complaining about the economic and fiscal weight of the prison industrial complex. It seems to be little alternative but other than incarcerating ever more broader sectors of the U.S. population. Now, it seems that the black and brown will be the first victims, but trust me, they will not be the only victims.
Gerald, what Michael didn't say when he spoke to you before is that two of our guests were actually school teachers in Houston, who were originally from Chicago and Atlanta, and they were talking about the various work that they're doing. You, on your efforts on your campus, is the import of what you're saying, does that help inform the discussion, and is there the interest of the student body there in taking these things to heart and really mobilizing and organizing around the fact of Black Life Matters, to put it simply?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly, historically, there has been a strain and a trend of activism amongst Black youth stretching back decades. But at the same time, with this parlous economic and financial situation in the United States of America, you have a number of young people who are desperately concerned about employment. And they have been made to believe and led to believe that staying out of activism and keeping their nose clean, if you like, is the surest route to find a job in a society where jobs are disappearing. And I think it would be naive to ignore that particular trend. There is another indictment, it seems to me, that needs to be made before time expires. You may recall that in the wake of the Great Recession beginning on Wall Street in 2008, that you had criticism and self-criticism by economists. For example, Paul Krugman of the New York Times excoriated many economists for not only not envisioning what was to come, but actually serving as cheerleaders as the basic pillars of the economy were crumbling. I think that in light of what I've said this morning, that historians need to go through a bout of criticism, self-criticism, because if you look at the way history is written in the United States of America, number one, there seems to be almost a de facto conspiracy between liberal historians and conservative historians. That is to say, liberal historians, it seems to me, paint an overly rosy picture about the United States of America, stressing the positive, even though the United States starts as a slaveholder's republic. They stress a constitution, by the way, which was designed to give rights only to those defined as white, so that they could be enticed to cross the Atlantic to North America so they could engage in the project of overawing and overmatching the indigenous and the Africans. And supposedly we're told that the Constitution serves as a template for the extension of rights to the rest of us, when we already know that many of those rights have not been extended to the rest of us, as exemplified by the fact that we get murdered in the streets and police officers go free. And so the liberal historians present this rosy picture of the past, which satisfies the conservatives because they don't want to deal with the ugliness of the past. And so they basically are engaging in this sort of mutual back-scratching, which serves to the detriment of the rest of us. I was at a conference just a few weeks ago at the CUNY Graduate Center of the city, University of New York Graduate Center, on slavery and anti-slavery. And it was remarkable. A person in the audience got up and asked a historian a question about the contemporary resonances of slavery and anti-slavery. And the historian answered, as his colleagues bobbed their heads in unison, that he was trained not to draw contemporary resonances about the past. And I was thinking to myself, well, what's the point of studying the past if you're not going to draw any lessons from the past? I mean, it turns into an antiquarian enterprise. But I think that that also serves a political purpose, because they do not want to draw these necessary connections between torture of the enslaved and torture in so-called black sites in Romania and Poland and Morocco and Thailand. And so it seems to me that the American Historians Association, which is the major body of historians, which is meeting in New York in a few days, that they may want to go through some self-criticism, although I doubt that that will happen. And so therefore, it seems to me that it would be quite appropriate for Black Lives Matter and other groups to throw up a picket line around their hotel.
I'm sure that that's exactly what's going to happen now that you've planted the seed. We have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. As I said, prolific writer, that's putting it mildly, probably what, you're now well into your next two books, which will take it up to, what, 28?
Well, you're in the ballpark. The next two books, since you asked, is Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, which will be out next year. And also out next year is Paul Robeson, A Revolutionary Life.
Oh, my goodness. I'm excited. And really encourage people to two of the most fascinating and important books I've read in years, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, Gerald Horn, our national treasure. Yes, thanks indeed. So much for joining us.
Thanks, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.